Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Comics and Graphic Novels, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Dr. Elizabeth Woke, a host of the channel, and today I'll be talking with Dr. Shamin Kwa about her new book, Perfect Copies, Reproduction and the Contemporary Comic, which was published by Rutgers University Press in 2023. Dr. Shamin Kwa is the chair of East Asian Languages and Cultures and Comparative Literature at Bryn Mawr College. Her written work explores relationships between form and content, text and image, self and self-presentation, surface and depth, and the conflicts between what we say and what we mean. Her research interests include theater and fiction, food studies, graphic narratives, literary studies, cultural studies, comparative and world literature, and literary and narrative theory. Her published articles analyze a broad range of topics, including Italian opera, contemporary Chinese literature, and North American and European graphic narratives. Analyzing the way that recent works of graphic narrative use comics, the comics form, to engage with the problem of reproduction, this book, Perfect Copies, reminds us that the mode of production and the manner in which we perceive comics are often quite similar to the stories they tell. Perfect Copies considers the dual notion of reproduction, mechanical as well as biological, and explores how comics are works of reproduction that embed questions about the nature of reproduction itself. Through close readings of the comics My Favorite Thing is Monsters by ML Ferris, The Black Project by Gareth Brooks, and The Generous Bosom series by Connor Stetzel, Sabrina by Nick Dersnaso, I'm going to say everyone's name wrong, and Panther by Brecht Evans, Perfect Copies shows how these comics makers push the limits of different ideas of reproduction in strikingly different ways. Kwa suggests that reading and thinking about these books push us to engage with these complicated questions and teaches us how to become better readers. In this interview, Dr. Kwa talks about comics as objects of reproduction, close reading comics, and how the look of things tells us how to feel. Dr. Shamin Kwa, welcome to the show. Shamin, could you start by telling us about your background and what led you to write this book?
Sure. Hi, thanks for having me. I started actually as a scholar of classical Chinese drama. I have a PhD in Chinese literature, and I was really drawn to Chinese drama because I had an interest in Italian opera, which may not sound like it is necessarily related to Chinese drama, but I was very interested in the relationship between musical language and spoken language. And in both the cases of Western style opera and Chinese opera, there's a balance between the aria and the more typically sung dialogue. And I ended up writing my dissertation about four plays from the Chinese tradition that highlighted the ways that people put on a new persona in order to achieve their goals. That may not really seem like it's related to the comics work that I've done. And to be totally honest, I'm not sure that it is either. Whenever people ask me how I transitioned from writing about drama to writing about comics, I think maybe there is a certain interest in multimedia, an interest in the relationship between words and performance, or how things look, the ways that plays can do that, you know, with irony, where someone's saying something but they're doing something differently with their bodies or with their expressions. But the probably more honest answer is that I really struggled with the job market when I finished my PhD. I was moving with my partner to another state, and there weren't that many jobs to begin with. And so I started thinking about what exactly I wanted to do with my life, and sort of fell into a bit of an academic purgatory, let's say, where I didn't really think about, how these things would turn into a job, and instead focused on doing things that I just thought were interesting. And part of that was reading graphic novels. Many of my friends who are also academics were reading comics and graphic novels and recommending titles to me. And some of them even sent me books to read. And I became absolutely absorbed by them. I couldn't stop reading them. And every book that I read seemed to open the door to more books. I read anthologies, which would lead me to more writers. And along the way, I stopped thinking about an academic career. And it was probably exactly then that I ended up getting a job and hired in the Department of East Asian Languages and Cultures here at Bryn Mawr. But I somehow couldn't let go of my interest in comics, and I had read a few that I felt really strongly about that I wanted to write about, and I think because of that long period of not having an academic job, I also had developed some people might call it resilience, but I think I called it something like, I don't give an F anymore attitude. And I decided that in addition to my ongoing work on drama, that I was going to really apply myself to trying to write about the comics that I really loved. And so I did that. I wrote a book called Regarding Frames for the Rochester Institute of Technology Press, and it was about some comics that I couldn't get out of my head. And that just started a snowball effect, I suppose. And when I finished that book, I felt like there were still some questions that I wanted to work through. I was really interested in comics that dealt with problems about families, problems about relationships between people. And while I had been doing that as a teacher at Bryn Mawr, I had been inviting comics artists to come to do workshops or to teach a class with me. And I had watched how they worked. And it had made me think a lot about the ways in which the actual physical act of making something became flattened or at least untouchable in the process of reproducing them. So we were doing this in class when we were making zines, and students would get disappointed because they were making a collage, for example, and then when you would scan it, it would sort of flatten the whole image and you couldn't see the layers. And sometimes the colors would be bleached out. And, as with most things, I would say, well, this is an opportunity, right, to think about what that's saying about the process. And as I was saying this was an opportunity, I think my head was working on those questions also. And I decided to propose this book, Perfect Copies, to an editor who at Rutgers Press who had been interested in what I had going next. And that brings me to this book and how I ended up working on it. It was a very natural progression of ideas that I had been thinking about, teaching, wrestling with for the intervening years. And I was lucky to find an editor who was interested in pursuing those ideas with me. And that's how I came to write this book.
Sounds perfect. So a few photocopies and we're on our way. Great.
Exactly.
So you open the book by talking about Gareth Brooks's work, and I have to say, I love his comics. If he's listening, we love your comics and graphic novels as well. Ah, praise. So which artists, in addition to Gareth, inspired you or helped define your understanding of how, and this is what you say, how the look of things tells us how to feel?
I think Gareth's work was very important for me in my formulation of that idea. I had done a lot of sewing before I started working with embroidery comics like his, and he had come as an artist in residence for a few days a few years ago, and we had done an embroidery workshop together, and it sort of started me embroidering and really thinking a lot about the backs and fronts of fabric and how one could reproduce that in a page and how to line them up to make them look as if they were that same piece of fabric. This was a question that I had been really interested in, even reading literature in general. I had always thought about how sometimes a page would have a bleed through, right, where you could see the text from the other side of the page, and how sometimes that could be a tell, right, whether it's a watermark or whether it's a stain or something like that. And so I was very interested in those questions already. So when I read Emil Ferris's My Favorite Thing is Monsters, which is itself a copy of a notebook, right? It's supposed to be a child's journal that she's keeping in this kind of three-hole spiral-bound book. I felt like there was something that was going on across a variety of books where artists were deliberately doing things with media that were decidedly material, right? That they were sort of saying, look, I'm giving you this simulacrum of something that I made with my own hands. And it inspired me to think through why this was happening at this certain period in the late 20th and early 21st century, what it might have to do with our other kinds of technologies of reproduction, the ways that we interact with rectangular objects in general. I was thinking a lot about my smartphone, actually, how it's also a rectangle, also in portrait mode, also an object that I hold in my hand, but which actually gives its content or the writing or images that are on its surface in a very temporally fixed way, right? That the object stays the same in the hand, but the content in it is constantly changing and also impossible to hold on to. And so I think all of those questions were feeling incredibly insistent in my daily life. And I've learned to trust that when something appears everywhere around me and, a kind of becomes an obsession, that it is something worth pursuing. And so yeah, Gareth, on one hand, with the embroidered work, and Emil Ferris on the other hand, with this painstakingly created ballpoint pen and felt tip marker on what seems like very cheap throwaway student notebooks, and how they use these materials to make the reader really feel confronted by that question of the real thing and the fake thing, and whether they should care.
Important question whether they should care. We'll get into that. You write that comics are natively objects of reproduction. So you gave two excellent examples there, but in this broader sense, they're all natively objects of reproduction. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Sure. I think, you know, when I was in college, I had taken an art history class where we were looking, you know, at the work of Roy Lichtenstein and the large comics reproductions he made. And I was really struck by an argument that was posed by the philosopher Arthur Danto that talked about how that work of art needed to be experienced in its real life form, right? That it was a copy of a comic, and its own theory of art was defined by the size, the scale of the work, right? That it was that the little dots were now very large, and the work of art itself was partly, if not majority, defined by that shock that the viewer has by encountering it in its scale. And Danto made the point that when it's reproduced in a book and it's reproduced next to the reference comic panel that it's copying, it loses entirely its sense of itself as an artwork, right? That it no longer is this painting. It's no longer the work of art that the artist was creating, because it's now simply, you know, the same, really the same visually as the original work that he's copying. And I thought about this assertion in the context of the comic book, and whether the comic book, which I, you know, argue is a work of art, is subject to the same restrictions about what makes it a comic, that's something that's consumable. And I felt that in learning about the processes in which these artists were making their works, in my own personal encounters with these works, that these books were designed expressly with the idea that they were going to be reproduced as such, right? That perhaps the artist would be making something on a larger scale. And I, you know, I've had the great privilege of seeing how different artists work in different sizes, even as they know what the ultimate format of their book is going to come out in. But that they were producing these works with this idea that there were going to be multiple copies, and the more the merrier, right? That this was part of the beauty of comics, was this idea of distribution, this idea of having it reach other readers. And it felt very democratic. It felt very exciting. It felt like something that was a fresher relationship to art and access. And that's what I meant when I was talking about being a native object of reproduction, that it was sort of asserting the joy of reproduction, and maybe realigning the ways that we think about the quality of a reproduction versus an original, right? That there isn't this idea of an original on a pedestal versus an inadequate copy, because all of them are identical, more or less, copies.
It's so funny you say identical copies. I did hear one particular comic book artist comment on the second printing of their own comic book, that they were disappointed with the paper of the second edition, or something like that.
And actually, as I was saying that, I was thinking also of the productive possibilities of slight irregularities in printing processes. And in fact, one of the chapters in my book is about the artist Connor Steck-Schulte, whose comics are printed on risograph so that each page is always different, right? So there's a slight variation in each copy, and yeah, to your point about the different kinds of paper, I too have had conversations with artists who have been frustrated. I probably it's best to leave out who was saying these things, but you know that it's a quite frequent comment that they have this idea of what they want it to look like, and because of reasons of cost or otherwise, the paper or the quality of the print or the way that the scan came out causes them to be incredibly disappointed with how it looks. And in many ways, that can be productive for us as readers, right? Because it draws our attention to the complications and the obstacles that emerge with any act of creation.
And getting to the readers, I'd like to segue into another quote from your book. You, and I'm quoting you, propose in this book to progress with a reading practice that is surface-based rather than to claim that one can, quote unquote, get past a surface. Could you describe what you're trying to correct about the reading process with this new process and explain to readers of comics, academic readers, or maybe casual readers, how to engage with this practice?
Sure. I think a lot of the ways in which we have been trained to read, and I mean, especially in the classroom, is to adopt what the critic Paul Ricoeur called hermeneutics of suspicion, which he was describing as an attitude towards a text that it was hiding something, right? That you may think that you're reading a play about a prince who's come home from college and his father is dead and his mother has remarried the father's brother, but it's actually, you have to dig deeper beneath the surface and understand that the son is in love with his mother, right? That there's a Freudian reading here where the son desires the mother, and that is why he is so unhappy and wants revenge. And that is, you know, a reading that we would tell our students or ourselves as students can be a compelling reading if we find enough evidence, right? That it's not something that is obvious or on the surface of the text, but something that's hidden. As I was describing Hamlet, and so as in the play, there are so many times that people or events occur off stage or behind curtains, and the reader or the audience member has become accustomed to thinking that there's something else behind. I think that this is actually an incredibly powerful way of engaging with a literary text and or a visual text, and in fact, any cultural object. But I also want to valorize the fact that there are also wonderful, exceptionally interesting things that work on the surface of the text itself, right? That there are things that are actually available to the reader that are not hidden. And in fact, I want to argue that the things that we say are hidden, that are in the depths of the text, are actually only accessible to us because the evidence is there on the surface. So for me, a surface reading approach is about that aspect of reading, about sort of having a certain generosity towards a text, to not assume that it is being jealous or guarding something and hiding anything, and that in fact it may actually be a flaw or a lack of knowledge or feeling from the reader themselves, right? That if we can train ourselves to be closer readers, to be better readers, we become more available to see what is already there. And I think that's really what I'm getting at with surface reading, that I'm not at all saying that meaning is that only what is immediately available is interesting, but I am saying that we don't need to have this antagonistic relationship with the text where we have to win or conquer it, as much as we need to think about how we can be better readers, what things we need to do, whether it's learning the language or learning how to read music or learning how to watercolor, that helps improve our understanding of the text and the work that went into making it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I feel like we could have a whole hour-long conversation on close reading in the age of TikTok and how to get at this. But just to keep it on a manageable scale, a taste test, if you will, for right now, your analyses in Perfect Copies are really based on close reading. Could you describe your process for close reading comics in particular, a very special type of close reading, which must have so many factors, the materiality, visual languages, style, layout, etc., that you have to close read in addition to the textual narrative, which is what we're usually taught to close read?
Sure. I think my close reading practice is based on a certain philosophy of slowness, which I think really speaks to your question about how do we do things in an age of the immediate and often fleeting, right? The things that disappear. And I found that the only way that I've been able to do this kind of work has been to give myself time to spend with an object. And in fact, I started doing this some years ago, and I now make it part of my teaching practice, which is to stay with an object for longer than I think I possibly can. So, I send my students into the museums to do this too, so that they get a sense of this. But I will find time to go to a museum, for example, and instead of trying to visit all the greatest hits, I will choose an object that I seem to have some sort of intuitive reaction to, or it's something that's interesting to me. And I sit and stare at it for a long time, sometimes an hour, sometimes more. I started doing this actually when I was an undergraduate in college. I went to Dartmouth College, where the student the museum there, the Hood Museum, had a Rothko, and it had a bench right in front of it, and you could just sit there, and the admission was free, and it was kind of a perfect example of how spending time with an object and allowing yourself to let that relationship evolve over time allows you to see more things in the object, right? The object's not changing, it's the same exact object. And you are more or less the same person, but there's something that's happening there across time that is cumulative, that is allowing for a more profound relationship with that object. And I like to think that philosophical stance about our relationships to objects or things may translate to our relationship with people. So to return to the question of comics, I guess my sort of non-analytical answer to this is that I tend to read a lot of things, and sometimes something is just really attractive to me and maybe even bothers me. And I can't figure out why, or I can't articulate what that thing is. And I'm sure, you know, everyone has this experience, right? You watch a movie and yeah, after the movie, you're like, you know, I still have to talk about this, you know, like, why did this happen? What was that thing? And close reading is saying, I'm going to return to that, right? I'm going to see why this thing is so sticky and why it's bothering me and what it is about it that makes it adhere to my mind. And then it's kind of taking it apart in all those different ways, right? Is it the language? Is it the way that how the language is written is confronted by what we're seeing? Once I get into that, I start thinking about how is what I'm seeing, how was it made, right? Why did this person use watercolor? Is the transparency saying something about how language is transparent? And it's really a lot of stumbling around in the dark, right? Like asking myself questions and saying, no, 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 that didn't work. You know, there's not enough evidence there. There's not enough stuff on the page that supports this intuition. So it's, for me, it's never been about reading something clever that someone else said and then saying, how can I apply it to this wonderful book that I love? It's really trying to figure out what makes that wonderful book wonderful to me. Hoping that by working out what made it wonderful to me, it might ring true to somebody else, and seeing if other writers, philosophers, critics have felt that way about something else, and seeing if I can kind of borrow their vocabulary, their frameworks, their approaches to shed some light on what I feel I've discovered about that text.
Thank you for insight into that process. It's so wonderful to hear you go into details about the interaction and the diving into the object. And in your book, you include a really wide range of case studies. So when we're thinking about the stickiness of some ideas or things like that, has one of the case studies really stuck with you that you're still thinking about it today? Or is there anything that you would have added that has been sticking with you now?
Honestly, no. I mean, it's not that I don't love everything that I still love all of the books that I've read, and often actually I sometimes return to the books that I've read. For example, I recently read Brett Davins's book, Les Rigoles, or The City of Belgium. I wrote about his book Panther in Perfect Copies, and you know, that is a book that has stayed with me. Actually, all of the books that I read and read for Perfect Copies have, but again, the kinds of things that change over time include my own relationship to that self who was writing that book some years ago, and thinking about what I saw then, whether what I saw then is still available, still true to me in light of the new work that the artist made. You know, the striking difference between my dissertation work on a 16th century playwright and my current work on living, working comics artists is that they keep making new stuff, right? And they're growing, they're making wonderful new things that I haven't anticipated always. And I honestly, I can't even keep up with some of them. And it's not that I want to say that I'm a separate person from this book that I wrote, but I guess I think of it as once I wrote it and published it, it no longer belonged to me in the same way that once these artists wrote their books and published it, they were kind of letting other people take it and own it and see it in their own ways and so on. I will say that one of the things that I wished I had had more time for were the artists that I wrote about in my introduction and in my conclusion. I wrote about the artist Jerry Moriarty in my introduction, who did the most incredible book called What's a Paintoonist, which is a reflection on his childhood. And it's done in three very different forms. There's pen and ink drawings. There are acrylic paintings that I understand from an interview he gave are larger. And then there are these even larger oil paintings. And of course, they're all compressed into comics panels for this reproduced book. And I wished I had had more time when I was writing Perfect Copies to write more about Moriarty's work. But actually, my wish came true because I ended up writing an article about it later. And I'm thinking about developing that for a subsequent book. And then, of course, I ended my book with the work of the artist E.A. Bethea, and Elizabeth's work is stunning, and it's a really interesting hybrid of poetry and image. It talks about memory, it talks about the subjective self, and I would love to talk more about her work, and just waiting for an opportunity to do that. So those are two things that I wish I had had more time for.
Okay, thank you. And also thank you for sharing those artists so I can get everyone to check those out. I love hearing new titles, new names on the podcast. And I just have it's a subjective question. So from what I took away when I was reading is that a lot of the comics or graphic novels that you chose are very visually intense. And I know this is subjective, but this is just what I took away from it. They have really vibrant colors. They're intense contrast, really bold line work. They just grab you visually. And is there something that attracts your scholarly attention to visual narratives that have maybe more weight on the visual side of the graphic narrative than the textual side?
I think in the case of this book, it was certainly a conscious decision that I was choosing works that felt like they were trying to challenge the copy. Right? That there was something that was, as you say, vibrant and alive about these works that I felt really were defiant. And in my first book about comics, I think all of these artists are really powerful visual textual storytellers, but I agree that in my earlier book, a lot of the texts that I worked with were often just black and white, ink and paper works. And in this case, I think I was very deliberate in my choosing of texts that made you want to touch them, and then left you with this feeling of having been repelled by that desire, right? It's impossible. I really feel like it's impossible to pick up a book by Garth Brooks, that's an embroidery comic, and not feel extremely frustrated by the fact that the page is smooth and that you can't touch what it is promising to your eyes, right? That you can touch it, but it's a absolutely not what you see. And as I said with my example of the smartphone, that's actually what we do all day, right? We look at photographs and at cute animals and at food. We're constantly, at least I am, constantly watching people cooking things or showing restaurant foods, and I can't smell it, I can't touch it, I certainly can't taste it. And I wonder if it's saying something about our relationship with these copies. And so in the case of all of these texts, I certainly was originally attracted to all of them because of that arresting promise of physicality, of vibrancy, of liveness with all of them. But I certainly love the words too. I think if it were just image with a kind of a flimsy textual narrative aspect, it wouldn't be as arresting to me. So I'm not sure if I answered that question, but I guess it's one of those like yes and no answers.
We'll take a yes and no answer. It's perfect. And you gave us a little hint before already, but now we'd really like to hear the big picture. So what are you working on now, and what are you excited about?
So actually, I'm working on a couple of projects right now. The big project that I'm working on is actually on the topic of food. I'm writing a memoir, a nonfiction book for the trade press about Chinese food in America and the relationship between this idea of Chinese food and the idea of being Chinese in America, how we try to be efficient with language, and we think that we understand what we're saying to each other when we use words like, Chinese food, and the problems, I guess, this is a recurring metaphor in the work that I do about the conflicts, right, between what we're hearing and then what we're getting. And so I'm writing about my own experience as an immigrant to America when I was a preteen, and how it relates to this larger question of Chinese food, Chinese restaurants, Chinese menus in America. And it's called The Secret Menu, and I've been working very hard on it, if my editor is listening.
Fabulous. Will be illustrated.
No, actually, it's a text only book so far. But maybe we'll have a website or something that's linked to it. And then I continue to work on writing about comics. I have the Jerry Moriarty article is coming out in, or maybe it's already come out in the Routledge Companion to Literature and Art, which I think was set to be published this month. And I am also have an article about the artist Lila Korman and her work with watercolors. And maybe it'll turn into a book. I'm really interested in pursuing this question of materials, artist materials, and time. So that is another project on the horizon.
Right, fabulous. Looking forward to all that coming out and looking to see how your work develops. You're going in so many different directions. It's really exciting. Dr. Shamin Kwad, thank you so much for your time today, and it's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Same here. Thanks for having me.